online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, grower champagne. In vogue, the market for it has never been thirstier. So what's all the fuss about? Essie Avalan, MW, is my guest this week, a world authority on champagne. She'll bring us her critical assessment as she shares insight for her special report on grower champagne for Club Onologique. Grower champagne has seemingly never been in greater demand. The fashion for it is fueled by a greater interest in provenance and a love for all things artisanal. The term generally refers to a champagne produced by the person who grew the grapes, and that is something of a novelty because many of the big names in champagne tend to buy at least some of their grapes from growers, while there are plenty of growers who choose not to go through the process of making a champagne. So what's the current state of that grower champagne market? Well, we know that it's hot, but how is the quality? Essie Avalan, MW, is a world authority on sparkling wine, and she's just completed a marathon assessment of 320 examples of grower champagne for a special report in Club Onologique. And I'm delighted to say she joins me now. Essie, welcome back to The Drinking Hour.
Hi. Thank you, David.
It's lovely to have you back, and a fascinating subject too. Before we get to the nitty-gritty of the report, I gave a very basic definition there of the term grower champagne. Is there a kind of rigid definition of what makes a grower champagne?
Well, the idea basically is that the grower grows all the grapes, him or herself, that the champagne is made of. And on the champagne labels, traditionally, you've been seeing with a small print the letters RM, Récoltant Manipulant, meaning the grower who also makes the wine themselves.
I mentioned how in vogue it is. It is really quite a sensation at the moment, grower champagne, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. When we're looking at the press or the restaurant wine lists, it's the grower champagnes have really surfaced quite quickly, now fetching amazing prices. They're some of the most sought after champagnes at the moment.
I mentioned there the kind of search for provenance and the love of things artisanal. I gave that as my kind of assumption behind the growth in grower champagne. Am I right? Is that really what's driving it, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. So it's really a part of this back to the rules, back to the basics, back to the soil, back to the hands that make it. So it's very much what we are witnessing today, these wines made in a very sustainable way, possibly organic, biodynamic, using as little any additives and so forth. So as pure and transparent as possible.
There are plenty of experts who swear by grower champagne. I have friends who drink little else when it comes to sparkling wine, and they would insist it's the best champagne you can get. But I'm assuming it's not quite as simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember that when we're talking about grower champagne, we are mainly talking about this, say, couple of hundred names maximum, more like less than 100 names. In the total pool of over 2,000 producers of grower champagne. Not all of their quality is great. Not all of them are sustainable at all. So we're really talking about this cutting edge new wave producers of terroir champagnes.
And there are those who caution that grower champagne is much more susceptible to the vagaries of vintage and vintage variation. Is that a fair criticism of grower champagne versus what we sometimes call the grand marks?
Obviously, the houses have bigger blending options when it comes to if a certain region in Champagne has a problem. If a grower is based on that region, of course, there's a problem. But I think it's more the size that might be a hindrance to the grower, because it is easier. It's more rewarding to make champagne in larger volumes. You know, you can blend them to perfection, polish them, and the wines keep very fresh in large volumes. So it's definitely tougher to make champagne in small volume.
And I see that quite a few of the top performers in your list in the report are making non-vintage. And I had always thought that grower champagne sort of tended to be vintage specific, just because of the problems of having to have a huge library of reserve wines and that being difficult for a smaller producer. So does it tend to be more vintage specific, or are you seeing more non-vintage examples?
Well, I think it's the same as for houses as well. It is the non-vintage that is the bread and butter of basically all producers. But there are some who do release even their vintage cuvées so early that they don't, they can't get that designation of vintage champagne, so 36 months on lease. And therefore, even if the wine is made 100% of a certain vintage, the label might carry non-vintage on it.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, tell us about the report then and how you went about assessing these grower champagnes.
Yeah, it was a great, actually, two-month project when I was touring in Champagne, visiting a lot of the most interesting producers. But then we also contacted a quite broad but well-selected list of growers who we knew that might have a chance of doing very well in the report. So we put like the sort of 88-point limit as the threshold of making it to the report, because that's the quality level where I think that wines are recommendable above 88 points. So basically, we organized big 3-day tasting in centralized tasting in Reims, where we collected all the samples. So I tasted them openly this time, each producer's range at one go, so that I could put them into perspective and look at the prices, the origins, the varieties, and wine making, and so forth. So I tried to put also in the tasting notes quite a lot of information about the grower and the making of the wine and the terroir especially.
So you're not judging blind here, as you would when you're leading the sparkling judging for the IWSC. You're looking at the labels. You know what you have in your hand here.
Exactly. Yes, I find that it's beneficial to do both of these things. Blind is blind, and then it's only the wine that talks. But obviously, when you know much more about it, when you have information about, especially you know the specific terroirs, it gives useful information to the consumer. And I think that the tasting notes are much more relevant.
And you're factoring price into your equation when you come to a score, are you?
Not that much, not really, no. It's later on one can look at the value for money, but the assessment is for the wine.
Kind of in that respect, it's like when you're doing it blind. It's a qualitative assessment, largely disregarding any thoughts about price. Yeah, okay. That makes a lot of sense. And you presumably know personally a lot of these growers.
Yes, absolutely. There were some that I didn't know, but largely, yes, I've been following them for a number of years. And I'm quite happy, I must say, that I'm liking at the moment grower champagnes a lot. There's a lot of new guys and girls coming all the time, every year, numerous new exciting ones. And I'm finding that the style is coming less oak dominant. There's definitely lovely oak influence in many of them, but not so dominant. And also, you know, I'm not a big fan of oxidation in the wines, and definitely I think that the newcomers are really, really careful about oxidation. So I'm enjoying it at the moment a lot.
Yeah, I was curious about that and exploring it a little bit more. That point on oxidation there, just for those listening who love champagne but don't necessarily know how to make it, what are you getting at there? What's the sort of the risk there with the oxidative process?
Yeah, I mean, naturally, of course, the process of making champagne is reductive as we age the wine such a long time on the yeast lees in the bottle. But the wine can be oxidized before it hits the bottle already. So then we are getting this sort of, especially if you're working with barrel or small volume, you're not not careful at every point in the making, there can be a bit of too much of oxidation, too much of an oxidative style, which many people consider a legitimate style. But I think the aromatics very often get very simple and aptly straightforward. There's like this veil of oxidation that hides all the lovely nuances in the wine. So I don't really consider it welcome at all. There's of course the noble oxidation, what comes, you know, over years in the bottle, bringing those lovely complex aromas, but that's different from this sort of premature oxidation.
That's the kind of deliberate part where the age is effectively naturally conveyed through the presence of some slow, very gentle oxidation. That's right.
Yes.
Okay. Well, which is delicious, I have to say. Talking of delicious, increasingly you're seeing that many growers seek transparency, purity, and mineral tension. And a number of them achieve that even with very low sulfites. That style there, that purity is something that you're seeing really emerging in grower champagne, is it?
Yeah, I think it's something that, you know, people really want to make the terroir speak, you know, as transparently as possible, with little masking as possible. And of course, in Champagne, we have very exciting terroirs, say many of the chalky soils, where you have this sort of naturally mineral imprint. And at the moment, when the climate is getting warmer also, there is this question of, you know, Champagne's minerality, how, you know, minerality is hard to explain or interpret, but, you know, a lot of it also comes from acidity, but now it cannot only be acidity. You have to maintain that tension in the wines, and you do get that tension from the soil.
It's interesting you mentioned minerality there, because when I talk to consumers of wine, you know, they're often very curious about exactly what minerality means. Now, I have my own definition, but frankly, yours is going to be a lot more interesting. So if someone
tell me yours, David.
I'll tell you. Okay, well, when I talk about minerality, I ask people to imagine that they have picked up from the purest mountain stream with incredibly fresh water. They've picked out a very, very smooth pebble from that mountain stream, and they've kind of licked that pebble, which sounds possibly slightly bizarre, but it's incredibly pure and refreshing, because you have that pure mountain water and you have that lovely, cool, smooth pebble. That's mine. I don't know what you think of that, by the way, as a definition. You're welcome.
That's a very, very, very eloquent minerality there for you. Yeah, no, it's lovely, because it's very much about that sort of texture, that mouthfeel, it's sort of dynamism, it's tension, it's that sort of, you know, wine's feeling very much alive, even without the bubbles. It's I really love minerality in wine.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, beyond champagne, you know, a really good, fabulous Sancerre or something like that, you know, that you get that wonderful freshness. When you guide people towards the wines they love, or the champagnes they love in this case, they normally start to sort of grasp that mineral point. It is incredibly important. By the way, how do you go about really achieving that in your champagne? What's the best way of showing minerality?
Well, I think it really is. I mean, first of all, it's about the age of the vines, how deep the roots go, where the vines are. I think, you know, this just example of say Cristal champagne, which comes from chalky mid slopes over 25-year-old vines. So and then you try to make the wine as transparently as possible. So really not masking it with too much oak or too much batonnage or too much anything. That's really when you really want to maximize that sensation of minerality in the wine.
And as you say, you're finding producers doing this very successfully. It sounds from the conclusion of your report like you're seeing a kind of new generation of growers emerging here alongside some of the great names among the growers.
Yes, definitely. I mean, we have had our pioneers and the next wave, but I'm really finding it fascinating now, the new ones that are coming, much broader spectrum of styles, like say in the report, the wines of Paul Gosset, which are made in a very intuitive way and really like without sulfur additions largely, and he still manages to make it work. And the wines are superbly deep and complex, and they come with a lot of character. So far from that sort of standard style of champagne, what we knew before.
Just mention a few other names, if you wouldn't mind, for those who are looking out for new examples of grower champagne, assuming they can get hold of these, because of course they're vanishingly rare very often because the production is so
Yeah,
low and the
maybe.
demand so high.
Yeah, exactly. And many of the top performers in the report, they are single vineyard champagnes. So do not only restrain yourself to those, because they are often quite expensive and hard to find. But just have to mention some names at the very top of the report. So for example, Ulysse Colin, who from the much, not so noble origins in the Coteau du Petit Morin, makes wonderful champagnes and amazingly immaculately uses his barrels to bring this sort of, I wouldn't want to use the term Burgundian when we are in Champagne soils, but those wines are just so beautifully crafted that, the Blanc de Blancs are just sheer perfection, with 48 to 60 months on lease. Very, very complete and complex champagnes. Then also in the report, the wines of Charton-Taillet did very well, where there is a lot of also from less famous terroirs in Murphy in the Massif de Saint-Thierry. He has a very unique way of making the wines. He lets them grow rather freely in the making process, and there's a lot of soul in his fine wines. Probably the most pedantic and skilled oak user in Champagne to me is Villemarte, whose wines are so stunningly well crafted, and they have such long-lived champagnes that it's really, really beautiful. And one of the strongest ranges I found was for Suenen, who is situated in Cramant and in the very noble origins of Chardonnay, and he really does an incredible job in all through his ranges from the entry level to the single vineyards. So those would have been some of my top names in the report.
And it's definitely worth looking at the report in detail for some of those names for those who want to at least try to discover some of these grower champagnes. From what you're saying there, to make absolutely excellent grower champagne, you don't have to be in those very top sort of Grand Cru areas of the Champagne region.
Yeah, I think that's quite curious, because often when we look at the Grand Marc top cuvées, they always come from the Grand Cru addresses. But here, in this case, the top 10 had I think it had six wines out of the Grand Cru's zones. So I think it's incredible. It tells about you need to be both a great vine grower and a winemaker to really be able to craft these artisan wines.
Is it fair to say that you're likely to get a greater sense of terroir with a grower champagne?
Well, I think we're mainly with the grower champagnes, we're of course talking about singular terroirs. With the Grand Marc, we're mostly talking about blended wines. And when they make a single vineyard, often the sort of house style is rather prominent there. I think what is fascinating in the grower champagnes is that you can learn so much. It's an intellectual exercise as much as it's palate pleasure, that you can taste these pinpoints in the Champagne universe, different villages, or you can find in the report, for example, in the top 10 of my Blanc de Blanc favorites, there was from Villemarte and Uray Frères, a single vineyard wine from the same plot, a Chardonnay, found its way to the top 10, which was incredible to compare two interpretations from the same plot by two excellent growers.
Talking of grape varieties, you report, by the looks of it, the greatest success with Chardonnay.
Yes, definitely. I was a bit surprised myself that I think 9 out of my top 10 were Chardonnays. That's, of course, that there it's a very popular style among grower producers. You know, when you're based on the Côte de Blanc or in say Mongeux or Villers-Marmery, you're likely to produce nothing but Blanc de Blanc. In that case, I'm not surprised. And a lot of the top wines nowadays are varietal wines, single vineyards. So it's not a surprise. And it's also not a surprise because, you know, Chardonnay is an easier variety to master. It's easier with the nature. It yields better, more consistently. The rot isn't such a problem. And also in the cellar, it's not so prone to oxidation as the Pinot Noir is. So it's definitely an easier variety to master in many ways.
When we talk about Chardonnay, there's a sort of shorthand where we talk about it being the winemaker's friend because it's a very malleable grape. It can be what the winemaker, to an extent, wants it to be. Is that also true when you're making champagne? Does the same thing apply? It's a more malleable grape.
Yeah, I think it's both, winemaker's grape, but it's also a terroir grape, as we know from, you know from Champagne, but know very well from Burgundy that it is able to reflect very well in all its sort of delicacy and neutrality. It does reflect the soil as well, but definitely you can add on a lot to the complexity of Chardonnay with the work in the winery.
Let's talk about Pinot Noir then, because you say in your conclusion that pure Pinot Noir champagne is a much more demanding style to master. Why is that?
Yeah, it's somehow a lot of the Pinot Noirs of Champagne, they are heavy, autumnal. It's just, you know, many times the blends just seem to require a little bit of Chardonnay for the added elegance and the freshness and the liveliness. So I think that, you know, it's not an easy variety at all, especially because it's prone to oxidation. I mean, it's still considered the king of the grapes in Champagne and many producers consider it much superior to Chardonnay. But definitely, as in the making of red wine, it is challenging.
That's what surprised me slightly because, as you say, Pinot Noir tends to have the edge among the critics, historically at least. Is that something that's changing? Do you think Chardonnay in Champagne is having a greater sort of level of acclaim?
Well, definitely, you know, Chardonnay's share has increased a lot recently. Prices we fetch for Grand Cru Chardonnay is extraordinary. It's in very high demand. But I don't really think that it's taking over from Pinot Noir. I think that a lot of the classic producers of Champagne really do appreciate that sort of depth and complexity Pinot Noir can give and are not looking to change that.
And then we have Meunier, which I often refer to as the Cinderella grape, which might be a bit lazy of me, but of course there is no Grand Cru Meunier, is there? Only Premier Cru.
Well, there is nowadays. I mean, if there is a Grand Cru village, any champagne grape planted there is able to, you know, have the name Grand Cru. I think there is, last time I checked, there was 40 hectares of Meunier planted on a Grand Cru terroir. So technically it is possible. But as you can see from the figure, there isn't much of it. Because I think it's been more valuable to put Chardonnay and Pinot Noir there, which get much higher prices as well. But yeah, I think Meunier, there's a great trend for Meunier, and there's lots that can be discovered still. And I don't think we've by far seen the heights that Meunier can go. It's really that only now, in the last 10, 15 years, people are putting their passion in Meunier and just wait and see. I'm sure we can in the future get fantastic Meuniers.
Yeah, passion for 100% Meunier is on the rise, you say, in your conclusion. And consequently, we are seeing some outstanding examples.
Yes, that's right. Well, there are a lot of producers who really focus on Meunier. I think Alexander Salmon in Chamusy, I think he produces 8 different 100% Meunier wines, some red, some white, some sparkling, some ratafia, things like that. So there's a lot of passion and a lot of learning taking place right now for the 100% Meunier, but it's also not an easy variety to work on. So I think, you know, the best Meuniers are still ahead of us.
Why is it not easier to work with, or why is it difficult to work with, I should say?
Well, it's quite difficult in the vineyards because of the way it grows. It needs a lot of work. And also, traditionally in Champagne, people have tried to get very big yields out of Meunier. But if you really want to make great champagnes, you should really restrict the yields for Meunier too. And then in the winery, it's the oxidation is quite prone to oxidation. So if you use a lot of oak, many of the examples just show oxidation and volatility.
So those people you mentioned who are going for 100% Meunier, they really have to know what they're doing. They have to be very determined.
Yeah, definitely, yes. And, one of the top scoring Meuniers was Alexander Chartonnier's Le Bar, which is a very unusual Meunier produced from ungrafted vines. So these rare vines growing on their own roots. And he really lets them, it's a wild animal, and he really lets it grow quite wildly in the barrels and bring a lot of, soul to the wine, much more than he allows the Chardonnays to do. So it's intriguing.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. And taking a bit of a risk as well with ungrafted vines because of the threat of phylloxera. Is that something that you see very often, ungrafted vines in Champagne?
There are some producers having them, especially on the Montagne de Reims and obviously Bollinger as well. They're rare, they're interesting, but as you said, there is always that risk that one day the phylloxera will get the vines and then you will need to replant.
Yeah, terrifying. Is grower champagne represented evenly? Because you mentioned there are many hundreds of growers making grower champagne. Are they represented evenly across the Champagne region, or are they more represented in specific areas?
Well, I've actually never looked into it exactly, but I would think that most of the ones that produce their own champagne would be located in the Marne area. So much more in the Aube, for example, the growers would have traditionally sold the grapes to the négociants. But nowadays we see a lot of growers, grower producers emerge from the Aube, but also from Vitria.
Okay, so it's something that is kind of spreading. We're seeing more growers, I'm assuming, become interested in producing their own champagnes.
Well, not really, because I mean there is more than 2,000 true grower producers, so ones that are not using a cooperative to vinify the wines. So there are many, and actually the numbers are going down. And it's because of you have to be quite the Renaissance man to be able to, you know, grow the grapes, do the wine, do the marketing, do the bureaucracy, and the finance. So, it's a tough job. And, especially in the international world with the changing market structures, many find it impossible and are stopping production and sticking to the production of grapes or even renting out their vineyards. So it's not easy. I mean, from the how much we talk about them in the media and how praised some of them are, it's not the whole reality, actually.
That is really interesting because, as you say, because it's in vogue, you assume that more people will want to do it. But it sounds like you have to be very good at a lot of different things.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. So it's for a small operation, you really need to be brilliant at everything.
The rewards are potentially significant, however. That brings us neatly onto prices. And you mentioned that you've seen a gigantic jump in grower champagne prices, and it's something you follow with concern.
Yes, I mean, still a few years back, I mean, grower champagne, even the great names, they were considered, you know, the value, good value options. But now really the situation has changed so much, and many of them fetch very high prices, which is, of course, I'm very happy that champagne and these growers are doing very well and they're getting added value to their production, but it's also a little bit dangerous for the consumer, because you know this interest can change very quickly, and when it's not really about value for money, when it's about the scarcity determining the prices, when we're talking about these top single vineyard champagnes, it's like when we talk about the Grand Cruze of Burgundy. The price is not, has nothing to do with the value anymore. It's about the scarcity.
Yeah, interesting. And some growers have taken steps to avoid their champagnes getting into the secondary market where people can effectively speculate with them. I think that's right, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Because we've seen a lot of speculation lately with some top vintages, especially the 08, and then producers like Jacques Celos. I think that there are many who really want to control the consumption, but the one that I think is being most successful with it is Ulysse Colin, who wants to sell the wines to the restaurants to make sure that wine-loving consumers still have access to them, that they don't all go to these collectors.
And when you're the size of a typical grower champagne producer, you can, to an extent, control who will buy your product.
Yeah, it's a very unusual situation, of course. But, you know, some of these guys are so small and in such great demand that they have been able to pull that off.
So looking through your scores, 96 points was your highest score, and you gave that to a number of those in your top 10. Just tell us how you're assessing what you're looking for and what makes a 96.
Yeah, I mean, 96 for me, they're really high scores. So it's, of course, a combination of a lot of things. I think complexity, the overall harmony would be one of the main things. Aromatic purity. I really do want my champagnes to be perfectly clean and pure. The intensity of the fruitiness, the palate structure, the length, the energy. I do want there to be energy and tension on the palate, finesse. And of course, one of the key characteristics is also longevity.
And how are you assessing longevity? You're looking at, based on the structural components, what you consider that longevity to be.
Yeah, exactly. How the harmony is now, how much is how developed is the fruitiness, what is the length, does it feel that there is more to come, and so forth.
And as you mentioned, it's rare that you give a 96. I have judged sparkling wine on a panel under your auspices, and I know you're a very, you know, demanding judge, and that's a very good thing, because people look at your scores and they will follow the scores that you give. Do you ever kind of get sort of stuck where you can't quite decide whether it's a 95 or a 96, or are you very certain normally when you come up with those numbers?
Normally, I'm quite certain. I taste so much that there's a lot of intuition to it already. Of course, I might consider it a little bit, and you know, certain wines actually need a bit of time to open up and show the way they're going. Are they opening in a positive way, or are they sort of breaking down quickly? So I might then change my score, but usually. Usually I can make it quite quickly and stick to my first score.
And I'm sure these producers are delighted with their scores. Just a final question. We normally talk about a desert island wine of some kind on the Drinking Hour, but I've talked to you before, so we've kind of done that. But out of this selection, if you had to go back and you could only have one, and I'm assuming it would probably be one of the 96 pointers, but you know, if you had to go back and have one just to really enjoy right now, and you had that full range available to you, This might be a horrible question to ask you, but yeah, which one would you go back for?
I know that, you know, I've answered that desert island wine question for you on the houses, so I need to do it on the growers as well. And there is one wine that I would never say no to. In no circumstance, I would always want to have it, and that's Ulysse Collin Les Enfers. So it's one of those single vineyard Chardonnays of Ulysse Collin. Absolutely complete and beautiful wine.
Well, it sounds wonderful, and frankly, if that's the one you're going for, then I imagine there are plenty of people listening who will know your work, will be thinking, well, I'll have a glass of that too. Thank you very much. It's a fascinating report. Great that you've put an enormous amount of work into doing this. It, as I say, makes fascinating reading. So, Essie, thanks so much for sparing the time to come on and talk to us about it on The Drinking Hour.
Thank you, David.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
Okay, it's time to round off after all that champagne with a few spirits. The results for 2023 at the IWSC have just been released after judging a month ago. Over 4,100 entries from 98 countries. Wines, by the way, not judged quite yet. That happens next month, and I shall be involved with that. Looking forward to it. This year, in the spirits category, 99 entries were awarded a coveted Gold Outstanding medal. In addition, there were 379 gold medals, 1,417 silver, and 1,512 bronze medals. That is a lot of tasting. The Glendronach Distillery 21-year-old Parliament Single Malt Scotch Whisky was a Gold Outstanding Medal winner with 98 points. I mention this obviously because it's a great medal, but also because Master Blender Dr. Rachel Barry, who's in charge at Glendronach, was my guest recently for episode 100 of The Drinking Hour. Really enjoyed that. Well done to her and the team. Of this particular single malt, the judges said rich fruitcake on the nose with sweet and spicy cloves, leading to a balanced palate of dark chocolate, savory notes and firm tannins, giving complexity and balance and finishing on a long, juicy raisin mouthfeel. Rum performed incredibly well this year. Havana Club International Añejo 15-year-old Gran Reserva Rum won a Gold Outstanding medal with 98 points. The judges, overseen by Ian Burrell, a previous guest here on The Drinking Hour. He's a great listen if you missed that. And here's what the judges said under his auspices. Lifted aromas of orange and pear fruitiness, a touch of poppy seed spice with juicy pineapple on the palate, well-balanced vanilla and fine oak with a very elegant creamy peanut length. Incredibly complex and a real joy. Heavenly, they said. Here's another Gold Outstanding Medal winner, one of my favourite tipples, actually, an Armagnac. Bactar Spirits 1973 Armagnac won Gold Outstanding, the judging panel overseen here by Joel Harrison, a mousquetaire d'Armagnac and a regular guest here on The Drinking Hour, talking about his passion for all sorts of spirits, but Armagnac being most definitely one of them. And here's the tasting note, zesty blood orange and Karani leather with raisins, dates and burnished oak, aromatic and rounded with expressive wood, tar concentrate and a perfect balance of chocolate, dark vanilla, honey and sugary soft spice on a long and satisfyingly chewy finish. Time for a gin. When isn't it time for a gin? This one's from Down Under, Four Pillars Distillery, Bloody Underhill Vineyard Shiraz Gin. A really innovative producer here, and their Bloody Shiraz gins are just fabulous. This one won a Gold Outstanding with 98 points. The judges said a lusciously bold, expressive gin supported by an unyielding backbone of rippling Shiraz. Radiant on the palate with wonderful flavours of smooth vanilla, spiced fruit, white pepper, and a deep pool of cool eucalyptus on a gorgeously herbaceous finish. Love that tasting note. Finally, another Gold Outstanding gin winner. This one from a bit closer to home, number one Isle of Skye 57 Degrees Sky, Earth and Sea Gin, also won 98 points. Gold outstanding then. The tasting note, the nose is oozing with fresh juniper notes combining with lemon peel, citrus, floral notes, coriander and cardamom, herbs and earthiness shining through on the palate. Well integrated and good mouthfeel with overall balance and roundness, showing a great typical gin. That's the tasting note from those really in the know, those judges. I happen to have recently tasted that particular gin and it blew me away. It's really absolutely delicious. And as the judges said, it just shows wonderful gin character. They don't always, these sort of premium gins, but this one really does. Absolutely fantastic. So well done to them on the Isle of Skye. And that is it. Thank you for joining me on this edition of The Drinking Hour. My thanks to SE Avalon, MW. Don't forget to head to clubanalogique.com to find her champagne report. It's emblazoned across the front page of the website. And you can also find my column at Club O2, not currently emblazoned across the front page, but they're all the same. So do please do that. And you can follow us on Instagram or Twitter. You can follow Club Analogique. You can follow Food FM Radio, or you can just follow me, or you can do all three. I'm Mr. Venusaurus on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for listening, and for now, it's goodbye.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode, in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.